The committee will come to order and folks will take their seats. I apologize for running a little bit behind, running on legislative time. I apologize for that. Different sort of clock, I suppose. I want to thank everybody for being back. We're in a little different room, but a little closer in. So hopefully we can make that work. Appreciate everybody's indulgence last time. Apparently it was just the fish. I was fine the next day. Not too bad the next day. I didn't eat at the same location. I ate at a different place. I didn't get the fish. I actually skipped over that, so hopefully I can make it through at least one session. Appreciate everybody's everybody's contributions last time. It was a lot of discussion and a lot of very meaningful discussion. One of the things we're going to attempt to do today, once we get into this, is to try to go through some of the specific elements involving the board and see where we get. And I just want to say, you know, up front, make sure I say this up front, everything we do today, and I may do a show of hands on some things, but I mean, not as a recorded vote, not as cast in stone or anything like that, but to see if we can maybe get a sense of the committee on some of these issues, subject to coming back and saying, well, no, you know, we thought this size committee would work, but we really think maybe a different size committee would work better. I mean, that's fine. Nothing to be cast in stone. But we do want to try to the extent that we can, begin working through some of the specifics and trying to get a little closer to seeing what we can resolve or what we can come closest to on a number of these items, and then we can begin to move on to some of the other topics that we've got to work with. So we'll see how far we get today. First, I think, are the minutes out in the packages? Okay, if you've had a, I don't think there's anything earth-shattering in there, but if you've had an opportunity to review those, or even if you haven't, if someone wants to make a motion to approve the minutes, anyone? Representative Hurley moves, and seconded by Commissioner Farmer. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, like sign. And the minutes are approved. I will mention, of course, our sergeants at arms that are here with us, helping us from the House, Young Bay, Garland Shepherd, from the Senate, James Blackburn, and Billy Fritcher. And we appreciate their assistance as always. If you need anything during the meeting, and of course, I'd remind you, because most of you are familiar with the set up here in the General Assembly, but you know there are restrooms out that way, and there are also restrooms around behind as well. And I think there's some coffee over there that's not too terribly old. If you find the need for that, that'll be just fine. Also, these mics work the same, if I remember correctly. They don't stay on. This one stays on, and the chairs mics stay on. But you will have to sort of push your mic and hold it so that they can be recorded. And appreciate you doing that, because it just makes it much easier for Ms. Hobby to be able to get all the comments recorded correctly. Also, a couple of other just housekeeping reminders. Be sure to fill out your reimbursement. I guess yours looks different. Ours are simpler because we're legislators, so they have to be simpler forms. So yours more complex, but just be sure to fill it out and get it to Ms. Hobby back here in the brown before you leave. So that can be taken care of. Please leave your folders. You take any of the material out of them that you want, obviously. Take all the material out of them, but leave the folders, and she'll gather them, and we recycle those. Okay. Well, let's see if we can maybe move in to first couple of things that we were trying to go back from the last session. And I'll tell you what, before I dive into that, does anybody have any questions or any issues that you want to ask about off the bat before we just start charging into what we're working on? Okay. All right. Very well. Start out with something that's, well, I say simple, but nothing's ever simple. And that's talking a little bit about, let's see if we can maybe focus in some on the size of the governance boards. As, of course, as you know, last time, just to review, we did a lot of discussion with respect to the governance boards for the MCOs. And so what we want to do is see if we can begin giving this maybe a little bit better shape. So we want to try to work on going through, size, terms. I think attendance is an issue. Training, which probably get a lot of consensus on that. And then some of the more difficult issues of board composition, appointment process. We've got, I think, some models that we're going to show you that sort of coalesce some different ideas, and we'll see how people think about that. But the first item that we've got up for some discussion, and since people didn't like my writing last time, which I don't like it either, we tried to do a little bit of preparatory work. Looking at some of the different realms, and we've got 13, 17, or 21. Now, there's nothing magic about those numbers as options. But what I'd like to do is to get start to get some feedback on what the group believes is a good workable number for the MCO boards that we're going to end up with. So let me open it up to anybody that has some thoughts or considerations right off the bat. Somebody say something. Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I talked with the Sand Hills director, and she said that they're, I know we talked about the commissioners and the mayors, and she said theirs always came. We have two from Randolph County, and she says anything more than 30 would definitely be too many, but with eight counties, and they're going to add Guilford, I think, coming in. So if they're, this one particularly is working very, she says, excellent. So I just throw that out there for information.
Okay. Y'all know, Ms. Shipman.
Okay, I, just would encourage us to keep the size small enough that, it becomes, it's able to be a very cohesive board. A lot of boards, if you read kind of the literature, really recommend, no less than 7, no more than 11. And you really want a board that's very involved and where all the members feel they're needed and are critical to the operations of the agency. So, I think the fewer, the more involvement and more buy-in you would have from the members. So that's just kind of my feeling about it. I know it's hard because there's so many stakeholders, but, I just think small is helpful.
Okay. Ms. Weaver.
I think there needs to be one from every single county. That would make a maximum board of 19, I believe, for the largest area. If you don't have one from every county, you're going to have some very upset counties.
Well, let me just explore that for a second now. Are you thinking one person, irrespective of whether or not they're a county commissioner appointee? In other words, irrespective of how they arrive on the board?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Ms. Coker.
I think that the key is not so much size as meaningful participation. Does somebody feel like their time is valued on that board? And I think that it's hard to talk about size unless we do know more about composition, whether or not counties and how they're going to be represented. But, you know, to me, I don't think the size is as much the issue as how meaningfully are the board members included in the information processes, so that when it comes time to voting, they really know what they're voting on, instead of just having like a small subcommittee that knows everything and everybody else just is the little amen corner for them, you know.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Riley.
I agree with you, Ms. Coker. I'd also suggest that you consider the possibility of having a consumer each from mental health, developmental disabilities, and substance abuse, and a family member each from mental health, developmental disabilities, and substance abuse. The three different fields being quite different, the policy and services driving them being different, and the interest oftentimes of consumers and family members being different. Thank you.
Okay. And that does, just a member from last time, one of the things that obviously we spent quite a bit of time on was board composition, and we laid out a number of different types of folks to be on that board, skill sets, perspectives, and the like. That obviously is going to have to play into what size board, and the obvious points. If you have it too big, it's going to be unwieldy. But you got to have it big enough to accommodate or attempt to accommodate the interest that you're trying to have on there.
Yeah, I guess this is sort of related to board size, but. Maybe it's more related to the size of the geographic area that board members are coming from, but I'm wondering how LME boards actually, when they come from a large area and they're a large board, how good the attendance is, and if one of the ways to deal with difficulty getting attendance from board members living far away, if boards meet in some, if one can attend in some electronic form or through telephonic or electronic communication, if that is something that is happening to accommodate the wide area, the long distance that people are coming from, I think it's someone should look into the degree to which attendance and voting is actually authorized, if that's actually authorized to be done electronically and through what medium. I don't think that the law is clear on that right now. Hate to throw up another issue, but if you're trying to get 30 members or 24 members, and obviously it's clear that, you know, a smaller board is a less wieldy board. I think you do have buy-in, like Pam Chipman says, but I think the resistance to a smaller board is that people are trying to accommodate so many different interests. And so there's a tension there.
That Mr. Parker, do you know what the state of the happen to know what the state of the law is on that?
As far as Chapter 122C is concerned, I don't think it speaks to what constitutes a effective vote or whether that it could be allowed electronically or not. It could take just a little bit of research as far as basic open meetings law, as well as I believe people within the Institute of Government have spoken to what type of public transactions can take place over the phone or via email, but we could probably look into that. But the current mental health law does not speak to how the board shall meet and how they may take a vote or not.
Okay. I don't know if anybody has any particular experience with that. Okay. All right. Well, what we'll do on that particular question, we'll have the staff do a little more research on that and come back with any research on that for the next meeting. Take a look at that. Yes, Ms. Cook.
One more thing, just based on a lot of feedback I've gotten since the last meeting, I think that we have to look at what is the function and role of the LME and the board. In a private, for-profit kind of setting, people may be thinking in terms of you know, a certain lens through which they're looking at their work. But in a publicly owned, publicly funded situation that's supposed to serve our most needy citizens, our neediest citizens, then I think that the board size being big enough to represent all these issues is going to be a value to the state. And so I just think it's real important that we consider, and I think Rosemary Weaver brought up a question at the last meeting. I don't remember exactly what it was, but do you remember what you said? There you are. About why are we doing this or something?
Well, I just wanted to be clarified so that everyone understood that we were still talking about a public system.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's definitely a public system. Okay. Well, let me just get a... Mr. Norman.
Yeah, I would just throw out that perhaps we should consider trying to come up with a minimum number and try not to come up with an exact number and allow each... LME MCO board make that decision for themselves through their own bylaws based upon their geographic area size, number of counties, and then you can take care of the special interest through advisory groups such as we do now with CFACT. I mean, we all probably also have provider committees in each of our LMEs. So I think there are other ways that perhaps we can look at it rather than saying, well, there's got to be 17 or there's got to be 21, but identify that minimum number, and that minimum number would probably be based upon back to the composition of who we think needs to be on that board.
Okay.
Bob Hedrick.
Is he Bob, counsel? I'm sorry, I didn't call
it's
you.
Okay.
Yes.
I had sent into the committee a recommendation. There was discussion last time on whether a provider who contracted with an MCO could in fact be a seated member appointed to the group, and there was some discussion on whether that was possible or not, and I spoke with Mr. Parker, and if he could address what his findings might have been, that would be a wonderful thing, and then I would have a comment, please.
Okay, well, it's Sean. Mr. Parker.
In relation to conflict of interest under the Social Security Act, Section 1902A4C-D discusses conflict of interest for Medicaid programs that must be accounted for by your state plan. Our current state plan has a provision that addresses that our Medicaid agency meets the requirements of Section 902A4C against prohibited acts and against conflict of interest that are as at least as stringent as the safeguards under Section 27 of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy Act. To get past the quick mumbo-jumbo, there's not an expressed restriction on who may or may not serve on your boards, but if the committee would take, I guess, at least the judicial notice that it is likely a provider in contract may fall under a conflict of interest by serving in this capacity. There is an express restriction currently in North Carolina statute for those who are under contract to serve on the board.
Okay, so not specifically under federal law, but it is under state law, which we are under state law.
It's specifically under state law, and I believe it could be interpreted under federal law. It would be restricted as well. I think that's fair. It could be argued, obviously, because there's not a... list of restricted persons or anything along those lines that we could point to directly, but as broadly as those conflict of interest and prohibited acts are written, it certainly could be interpreted that a provider in contract with the LME would have a conflict of interest in serving on that LME board.
So I guess the question is then, how would the state law and or federal law apply if you had an ex officio member, because I think that was the question was not necessarily a voting member, but the question is, would an ex officio member create the same conflict with state law?
I would still think you would need to rewrite your state law to allow for an ex officio capacity. Again, I think you probably would be in safer territory having an ex officio representative on a board than a voting member of the board as far as the federal prohibition.
Mr. Hedrick.
Yes, I would recommend that that be pursued as a potential change in statute that would allow an ex officio capacity provider with MHDD and SA experience to represent in that capacity on the board.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, probably what we would need to do there is probably do some more in-depth legal research on that question, because that might potentially be a much broader ranging issue over a lot more entities. And so what the parameters of that would be, I don't know. But we can get the legal General Assembly's legal staff take a little more in-depth look at that question and see what that scenario is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do that. Okay. Well, yes, sir. Mr. Farmer.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to piggyback on Mr. Norman's comment. I think that a minimum would better serve the boards. I'm thinking that each county would want to be represented, and 19 is the largest, so within the parameters on your chart, 21 would suffice. But suppose with the Medicaid waiver in place, as LMEs and MCOs are certified to administer, for some reason an LME becomes a 22 county LME, and then which county would be left out without a seat at the board if you use the 21 number? And that's kind of what I'm thinking, is counties are going to want a representative. And later when we talk about board composition, I would suggest that it doesn't necessarily have to be a commissioner. The commissioners may want to appoint someone from the community to represent the interest of business or consumers. But a limit of 21 could down the road come back to haunt us as we grow. So I think Mr. Foster's suggestion of a minimum number and let the individual boards determine what the maximum number would be, I would agree to that.
Okay, well, let's travel down that road for a minute then. Just let me get a sense of the committee. Did you want
to? Yeah, I was just going to add to that. That makes a lot of sense. And what you would do is at least one per county. That's the minimum. And that way it's in the program. That way you're, again, you have the flexibility. If you want to expand it beyond that, you can. But it's your own peril, I guess it would say, because once you get pretty large, and you're going to, you know, become unwieldy. But you've got to have at least one per county that's in the region.
One person, irrespective of what category they may
fall. Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. That's what would work out. Or you work out some kind of schedule so that you rotate, you know. Certain counties would have commissioners, others might have others, not somebody else appointed.
Ms. Copeland.
Yes, I'd just like to remind the group to that we currently do not have a default position of one per county, that there is another option to do something different, again, that is not necessarily readily exercised, but there is another option. And I think when we're thinking in terms of the 13, 17, or 21, we're thinking in terms of the current structure. And I believe you're asking us to start from scratch, if you will, possibly. So there may not be a one-to-one representation. Not saying that there won't be, but the context is that there may not be. And especially if the county chooses currently, as Mr. Botts explained to us last time, that is an option that they could choose, whether or not a regional representation or whatever the case may be.
That's right. That is correct. Well, as a just to go beyond the get past this first question here, in terms of size, if we were looking at it, for example, as a minimum, Just give me a show of hands if you don't mind. What does the committee think that minimum would who's in favor of 13? And 13 is just a lower number. Okay, it doesn't have to be 13, all right? But just for the sake of trying to get a feel for the committee, who would be more in line with a number closer to 13? Yes, for the purposes of this discussion. Okay. 17. Okay. 21.
Question.
Okay. That helps me. We got some differing views there. Okay, we'll come back to this. We'll come back to the size. We'll get into some of the other questions, and we'll come back to this. Let's spend a couple of minutes here. We'll see how long. On terms for the board, the board members, and these are... You may come up with a different scenario than this. It's perfectly fine. But just for the purposes of launching the discussion, the options that are shown up here would be two 3-year terms or two 4-year terms or three 3-year terms. In the first scenario, you'd be talking about a total of 6 years on the board. The second scenario, you'd be looking more like 8 years of service on the board. And in the three and three, that would be three times three, would be nine, upwards of nine, potentially 9 years on the board. I don't think that you want to, at least in my perspective, and if I remember the discussion from last time and others, no one is saying, well, gee, I have lifetime, you know, basically appointments to the board, because that can cause, it gives you institutional memory, but it can also cause problems when you go too far the other direction. I guess I would open it, the floor up to discussion as to if folks have a strong feeling on that one way or another, or think you should lean more toward the shorter period of time or the longer period of time. Ms. Troutman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do believe our last discussion, there was a lot of consensus about that the board terms need to be longer. I know that the discussion of terms has to do with a non-county commissioner representative on the board, that right now statutorily the board, the commission member that serves on the LME board at the pleasure of the Board of County Commissioners, that appointing authority, they could choose to have that board member's seat as long as they are in office with that county. The same thing with the county manager, who is appointed by the county in lieu of the county commissioner, in addition to the county commissioner, that he or she can serve to the length of their term as long as they're county manager. So I wouldn't want to displace that, because it seems to be working very effectively in a number of our LMEs out there.
I'm sorry, Ms. Weaver.
I would have to disagree with Ms. Troutman just a little bit, because on some of the boards where they have county managers and then they might have consumer and family representatives, the county manager terms don't expire, but the consumers and family member terms do expire, and that's not fair.
So, Ms. Coker.
I would add, too, that if you don't have a a county commissioner who's really knowledgeable and keeps up with everything, a community can be stuck in a bad place. And that has happened in the state, where that same person may stay for a very, you know, until that person decides not to run for office again or gets voted out. And he may, if he's not really knowledgeable and dedicated to that role, he may not be that responsive to the community's needs.
Ms. Shipman.
You know, we just recently switched from 2 4-year terms to 2 3-year terms, and just based on, you know, how that feels, it feels like 2 3-year terms is not really long enough because of the complexity, and so I would really love to go back to the 2 4-year terms or the 3 3-year terms, either way. But, you know, 6 years, you know, it just takes so long to really learn that, you know, we miss the 2 4-year terms, you know, because it's just been, I think, since 2006 or 2007 that it was switched to 3 years. So,
okay, Mr. Jordan.
Yes, excuse me. One of my thoughts had been that, as we spoke last month at this meeting, that there were certain subject matter experts that you needed with the new MCO nature to the LME board, and that that was something that needed to be a constant, because there is an expertise that you need to advise the board in that range, that maybe that there be a content period or a board term or a limit or a lack of limit for folks who are your content experts in regards to the business operations of that, and then there be a board term structure for those who are the community representatives in that, because the constant of this is going to be in the subject matter of how to govern the organization and the business that it's carrying out.
Just a question. Are you planning to start from scratch and the terms will begin in 2012, or those they apply retroactively?
Well, I think what would be done, or what's normally done, is when there are changes like this in the scope of boards, that it's usually a phased in. I would imagine that it would have to be structured on a phase in thing. In other words, it wouldn't just be a wholesale, okay, everybody's off the board. I don't believe we would do it that way. We'd have to figure out the mechanics of it.
Well, the question is, are you going to count back how many years people have served, and count them through the two, 3 years or three years?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, unless the unit group has some real strong feeling about that. But I'm assuming you would say, don't do that.
No, I think that will change the conversation, because you're looking for expertise. There is a bunch of people that are in the system that have been there 6 years, and you're starting fresh again, okay? You could have 9 years, then you're adding a lot of longevity until some people that have the expertise, so the absence of, or let's say, losing expertise won't be necessarily a problem if you start counting from zero.
So, but to make sure I'm understanding you correctly, that would be your preference, right? I mean, in other words, that would be your recommendation to begin the counting. For example, if we said, okay, 2 4-year terms, don't count prior service against that.
No, I posed that as a question as part of the conversation. I'm thinking about it.
Right. And I'm trying to find out what you think about that.
No, I think that there is I'm in the council's board, and there is several people that really know a lot, and to make this transition, no PBH for the rest of the people, you're going to need some people that know what the system is all about, and those people may be helpful if you start fresh with whatever it is. This is a new day, and you're counting from now on. And then the fear of losing expertise no longer will be there, because people, you still could carry on some people. Because if you say 2 3-year term and you're counting back, and some people already have 6 years, then they have to be off. What I'm saying is that needs to be part of the conversation.
I think that's a great point. Yes, Mr. Potts.
Yeah, something to consider. One of the differences between the 2 4-year terms and the 3 3-year terms, other than 1 year, is that the 3 3-year terms requires the county commissioners or other appointing authority to act more frequently, three times for someone to serve 9 years opposed to 2 times for someone to serve 8 years. So that may be preferable to some people. That means there's a potential for the board member's service to be up for review, their performance to be up for review by the appointing authority more often under the 3 3-years than the 2 4-years. So that's just something that people might want to keep in mind if they want to be able to distinguish or come up with a reason to prefer one over the other.
Oh, you're just...
I got a little back trouble, so I couldn't get down to sit there so close to Ms. Troutman, but I wanted to. You know, we need to get off square one here, folks. We can debate it to death. You know, I think 2 4-year terms is plenty. You get longer and longer, and to be phased in, as Raymond said, you have that expertise there, because we can't start clean with people that don't know anything about an LME and try to get up to speed and change over like we're talking about doing. So phasing in would be my preference, and 2 4-year terms would be my preference. You know, I just want to see on each board a consumer. On each board, some of the directors may not like that. Fact of the matter is, on many boards that I've served on, hospital boards, LME board in Concord, ends up being a lot of the members, the director, if he or she is any kind of politician at all, will develop a relationship with their board members to where it's yes, yes, yes. And I would expect a consumer could inject some differences of opinion about the services that they're receiving. So, you know, I would prefer to see at least a consumer on that board, not to be the emotional part of it, but just the balanced business approach that you're doing this. I mean, you know, we've got situations where one young lady who's in her 40s has been wearing diapers all her life, but we send somebody around every 6 months to check and see if she needs to continue to stay in diapers. I mean, you know, crazy things like that that the consumer could point out that is a cost to the LME that's unnecessary. So I think a consumer certainly needs to be on there, and 2 4-year terms is plenty. And always remember the leading individual in this state who has the highest paid retirement was an LME director whose board just kept raising his pay and raising his pay. He's number one. Number three is Dean Smith at $199,000 a year, and this guy makes more than Dean Smith. I don't understand how that happens in the state, but it does. So, you know, we need to not have a yes board because we need to move forward here. So, again, I'm being redundant. A consumer needs to be on that board, in my mind, at least one.
And we're going to get back to that composition question here in just a little while. But if I'm Ms. Cooker.
I just wonder how we can, without talking about composition first, all the other questions seem a little bit more difficult to me, but... you know, and looking at what we've been doing as boards is probably not the best thing. Just in the last week and a half, I have emails. I live in Winston-Salem. I have emails from the mountains, emails from the east, and somebody from a neighboring county about, in one case, an atrocious situation where the LMEs have known about but not responded. And I'm this is not a blame or shame on them thing. This is a how can we fix it thing. The board is so important. It's the board, of course, I know they spend a lot on insurance to protect themselves from it, but it's the board that bears the legal responsibility when things go wrong. And I think this discussion is so important, and it's got to be, it's impossible to say it can't be political, but it's so important that we understand what are the values framing the discussion we're having. And I think having consumers involved is so important because if you're partnering with your customer, you're going to learn more how to manage your product, your system, whatever you're doing. But it seems to me that we have to consider county commissioners, what their role is, how to strengthen it enough to where it really does matter for sake of the community. the people that have the expertise as far as management and outcomes, et cetera, but the consumers and families. I mean, those are three sections that I think we really have to take a look at and then think in terms of percentages. If we're not going to be able to have 18 county commissioners plus so many consumers and so many financial experts, whatever, then we may have to look at percentages. You know, what percentage, as a community member, I'd like to think that my county, my public system, has a third of its board be county commissioners. And if that means that they can't all come, that all counties aren't represented, then it puts a burden on the counties to study who are the people that have some expertise, either by profession or by family experience, or who may be a consumer himself or herself. Who are the people that can comprise this section? So the counties have a voice. The citizens feel like they can leverage some local control and input, and you know, everything would be more grounded as a public authority instead of it's just we're on shaky grounds right now, statewide right now. People are really wanting to know that this thing is going to go the right direction, because a waiver can be the best thing if it's really done the right way. And so much of that's going to come down to this discussion of what kind of boards we develop for it. Thanks.
Well, we definitely want to do it the right way. We definitely want to get there. Absolutely. I think we're all agreed on that. Well, let's do this. In terms of the terms, I think there's at least I'm hearing some consensus that we would either be looking at, you know, 2 4-year terms or maybe 3 3-year terms. If you have, I'm going to just, this is again just to help my thinking, if you don't mind. But I'll just ask between those two if you have a preference. If you don't have a preference, you don't have to raise your hand. But if you have a particular preference for 2 4-year terms, if you could raise your hand just to give me an idea. And 3 3-year terms. Okay. All right. Well, we're between those two options. And the next issue I want to touch on, this probably won't take real long, but I think there's probably going to be generally a good deal of consensus on the fact that we need to have board training, or at least I think that's the case. And I guess the question I would have in getting any feedback on is there currently is a requirement in there regarding board training, but the question is, do we want to make that a, and we don't have to decide about how much it would be strengthened necessarily today, unless somebody has some really good ideas on that, and frequency. But I guess the real question is, do we believe that that's currently sufficient, and do we want to beef up the training requirement for board members? Mr. Farmer.
Mr. Chairman, the current statute says that the department will conduct the training. I think we should change that to the area director, conduct the training, and that it be required for new board members especially.
You're saying area director in lieu of the department?
Yes, sir. Just a little background. 10 years ago, when I first came on the board, that was how it was done in my first mental health agency. The area director had a 2-hour training session with each new board member, and we did remove one board member for failure to attend 3 attempted training sessions. So we found that to be an efficient way to do it, to get the training so that the board members understood more about the business.
Mr. Norman.
Yes, I think we probably need to have some standardized functional areas, for example? Because I think any new board member or existing board members need to know about each one of the specific functions that the LME MCO is performing. And currently I do a two-hour orientation for any new board member, but quite frankly, that is not sufficient. And quite frankly, sometimes I meet resistance if I try to do more than that. So I think we need to have something that is standardized across all 11 of us, even to a standardized curriculum as to what we will discuss.
And it might be helpful, you tell me if my thinking is correct here, along the line of what you're saying, it might be helpful if there's at least a minimum amount maybe set out in statute. That way, irrespective of who's providing that training, you can't get beat up on and say, well, hey, you know, that's part of the statute. You know, that's what those legislators did down there.
Yeah, yes, sir, I would agree with that.
Okay, I understand that.
North Carolina is blessed with the school of government that have been able to put together a real good set of training programs that we celebrate, and it wouldn't be a bad idea, if that's possible. I know that funding is tight, to compromise the state to provide support to the school of government to really do on homogeneous training for the board of at least one full day for new board members, and then locally people could do something else.
Mr. Jordan.
Yeah, in conjunction with what my colleagues are saying, there almost needs to be an expansion of board training criteria at this point in time because of just 42 CFR Part 438 in regards to the MCO regs. That the board members would have to be brought up to speed on as we move forward.
If I could add to that, in fact, I was going to suggest the same thing, is that I just recently attended, I'm a liaison from our board to our soil and water conservation district, and every soil and water conservation district supervisor gets 2 days of training at the school government as part of their responsibilities, and they're handling them, and I'm not discounting now soil and water folks, but they have probably a smaller piece, you know, of tax dollars they manage. And so I think it's very important that we look at towards the school of government as a way of providing that training, and at least to be a day long for new board members.
Yeah. Ms. Weaver.
I'd like to suggest two things. Number one, that we have training that's ongoing instead of just being trained the first year you become on the board. I think board members should have ongoing training every year because things do change. And the other issue would be that cultural competency would be included because we all know that things are very different in the mountains as compared to Raleigh or compared to the coast. And that training on the different cultures is going to be very important for board members.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Copeland. Oh, okay, gotcha. Bob.
Mr. Chair, I would ask for your consideration of if you're going to do training. So much training these days is done electronically and with a standardized computer program. And people can study at that at their leisure. It gives them greater flexibility, and you may have better success at a more competently prepared board if you did that type of training as you figure out this standard that I certainly would support.
Okay. Ms. Riddle.
Just like to make sure that any training would be accessible in accessible formats because you are going to have people with a variety of disabilities on these boards.
That's a good. I think that's a great point. Mr. Simmons.
Thank you. I would strongly consider a real standardized package of training so that it's consistent across the state for the board members, particularly since you're moving into such a business-driven model of semi-managed care, finance issues that are critical for board members to understand. And maybe some support from the school business along with school government to put that kind of training together.
That's good. Ms. Copeland.
Just wanted to make the committee aware that the School of Government currently partners with the Council on providing training. It is standardized. It is also archived and accessible through the web or CD, DVD, I guess, so that that is a mode or a module that we've been using in the past, and it's been very, very successful. But I would like to concur or reiterate Mr. Norman's statement about focusing on the core MCO functions.
Okay. So I would gather from the comments that there'd be no objection. For example, if you had the, for example, the School of Government maybe bringing in some expertise with the School of Business to, you know, expand, and obviously a lot of things that have been in that package in the past are going to have to change to because of all the additional concerns that will be there, different nature of the concerns. But that be there in addition, in terms of training for board members, in addition to the orientation that the MCO directors are going to be providing to new board members. Is that sort of a fair, and get mostly nodding heads on that? Yes, sir.
I just want to add that the North Carolina Council has also done a wonderful job convening the conferences, so part of the training could happen while the conferences are taking place, so people don't only have to travel one time, for example.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to another one. In terms of attendance, and I want to make sure that I've got a good feel from the committee on this issue. I think has already been mentioned, and Mr. Farmer mentioned a moment ago, a scenario where someone wouldn't attend the initial orientation, I guess the initial training, and so they were gone. And of course, part of this is going to come back to, okay, is this an action that is left to the appointing authority to do, or would it be an action in which the board would make the decision? For example, if for the sake of example, if someone did not attend three straight meetings, and they weren't, I don't know, maybe had some extraordinary circumstances or something why they couldn't be there, that the board could act to remove that individual. Can I assume correctly that you would want the authority to remove those individuals prior to the end of a term to be with the actual MCO board itself, as opposed to being from the appointing, whoever might be actually appointing them to that board? Or do you want it to be left up to the appointing authority and the board?
I think it's best to go back to the appointing authority. That's what we do now, but we don't have that tool in our toolbox on the PBH board. I mean, we've got members that may not attend, but they're appointed by the local board commissioner, and that would be the accountability back to that board if they're not attending the meetings and things.
So it's currently...
We've set up, Model B, where the commissioners, each county appoint the board members, other than the commissioner that serves in that county. I think in that respect, you've got to go back to that appointing authority, and they should be the ones removed. Now, I think there should be a reporting requirement from the LME back to those counties that shows the board attendance of the members from their county, and then let them determine from there whether to replace that person or not.
Senator Tucker.
Thank you. The removal of a board member is done by the county appointees, the county commissioners. What if that individual who missed three or more meetings is the county commissioner? We had one county commissioner last year on our hospital board that got her feathers ruffled the first meeting and never attended another meeting the entire year. But yet, since she was a county commissioner, and they wouldn't say anything to her about it. So, I mean, I think, in my opinion, the board, not the appointing authority, but the board should be able to remove that individual, even if it's a county commissioner, because they're from other counties. They don't show up, three meetings, no excuse, you're out of here, whether you're Politico or not, seems to be the best thing. And I'll say this, too, having been a county commissioner, having numbers of boards to serve on, inundated with information much like we are here, I don't see county commissioners taking it as serious as you do or Commissioner Farmer do. A lot of them can't get any votes dealing with the mental health folks, and it's unless there's some sort of scandal or some issue health-wise that hits the paper, they're not real motivated. So I've not seen county commissioners that I've served with make the best board members to begin with. So that's just my opinion, and 2 cents won't get you a cup of coffee.
We have free coffee here. Free coffee.
Yeah, free. Some taxpayer dollars are paying for that coffee. There's nothing free in this building.
I set you up because I knew you would say it.
Actually, if I could add to Senator Tucker's comments, that's been one of the biggest problems we've had on our board, is one of the commissioners, and I don't want to say which county it is, but Senator Tucker probably could tell me which one it is. Well, we've not had, I believe, Ms. Shipman, we've had, I think several years, for 2 or 3 years in a row, we had no commissioner from that county to attend our board meeting.
Because they didn't come. Those weren't coming. Mr. Hedrick.
Yes, I was referring to the current statute that does say that, and one thing that may impact this is that it looks like the current situation is the county commissioners serve on the board in an ex officio capacity. So it may be that they're attendance may be impacted by that. Anyway, that's the way I'm reading 122C 118(1)(d). Is that the way that you got to read this?
Mr. Butts, I think, wants to.
This goes to the issue of I think the term ex officio means different things to different people sometimes. And that's what it means is, so sometimes people interpret that to mean they're a non-voting member. But that's not what it means. What it means is that they're serving by virtue of capacity, by virtue of their serving in another capacity. That's all that means. So they are a voting member, county commissioner members, just like any other member.
Yeah, that's kind of a good point about our other discussion as well.
Representative Dollar? Sorry.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to understand that it should be excused. I would think excused absences because, I mean, they should have absences, but if one is excused, do they have to be 3 consecutive or do they have to be, you know? I just think that if you're sick or whatever and you've been had a serious injury or a serious sickness, then they still want to serve. I just hate for them to be thrown off or something like that. Thank you.
Ms. Coker.
I guess I was just going to say, I think one of the frustrations about the language that we've had is it's not real clear, and it really hasn't. The roles of county commissioners seem kind of ambiguous, and I know this from our county struggling to understand through the years what its role really was, but basically, until pretty recently, they have felt like they didn't have any roles, really. That was just a token thing. And when you feel tokenized, you're not going to put a lot of work into what you're doing. So I think that clarifying language so that the responsibilities are really understood by all parties is going to be really important in helping county commissioners value and participate in a much more meaningful way.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's a point well taken. It certainly, a board member of an MCO, they should take it pretty seriously as an LME, but certainly even more so with an MCO, given that it's at risk. Of course, I guess ultimately the state's the one that's at risk, but still, you know, it is a level of financial responsibility and all that, that I think is some order of magnitude greater than the current system.
Yeah, because costs come from other sections, law enforcement, et cetera, when things aren't being optimally managed. So they have a stake more than the money that each county gives. The counties have a stake in this, and I really think they need to be a little more empowered. That would empower the local communities a little more, too.
Ms. Riddle.
The standard for attendance seems to me that it should have something to do with how frequently the body is meeting. I would just pass on that boards and commissions in the state requires that our membership attend 75% of the meetings. We happen to meet quarterly.
Okay. Mr. Norman.
Well, if we're going to go down this road of absences, then we're going to have to define what is excused and what is unexcused. As an example, currently at Southeastern Center, the bylaws aren't specific. So if someone can't make a meeting, they simply call in and say, I can't make the meeting. And we don't try to quantify whether it was a good reason or a bad reason, just that they called and told us that they couldn't be here. So we count that as excused.
Yes, sir.
I mean, it seems to me that whether an absence is excused or not excused, the result is that that service and that voice, that particular professional expertise or that tie to the community that that person was bringing to the board is not there. And I think we can stipulate that sometimes people are not there, not because they're a bad person, but because they're sick or maybe they're too busy. So I guess I'm just piggybacking on. I would say that at one time the statute said that the appointing authority shall declare vacant the office of a member who does not attend three scheduled meetings without justifiable excuse. So two things, without justifiable excuse within a 12-month period. So two things, it didn't say may, because right now they may. The appointing authority may remove anyone with or without cause. So it was shall. But then the wiggle room or the discretion was in determining what's a justifiable excuse. And so maybe that doesn't get you there. But, I mean, so I could have a justifiable excuse to not attend some board I've been appointed to. And if my service is important or someone sitting there and serving on the board is important, I don't take offense if someone else is capable of going. And really, the question is, regardless of the reason, if you're not there, your service, the needed service, is not being provided. That's one way of looking at it.
Well, I come at it from a, well, if you knew something about my voting record, you'd know where I kind of come. Some of you get that joke, but I'm a real big believer in, you know, you better all have an awfully good excuse if you're not. I mean, otherwise, you know, this is the kind of board, I mean, it seems to me that this is the kind of board that you really have to be there. And if you can't be there, then, you know, it's, then you don't really need to be on the board. Somebody else needs to be on the board. And that's not necessarily a comment on anybody's character or expertise or ability. It's just, you know, simply that the nature of the board, it seems to me, requires everybody to you know, to be there unless there really is some extraordinary circumstance. And if someone's establishing a pattern in which they can't make it, then we really do need to be rethinking about whether or not that person has the time or is situated sufficiently to be able to render that service. Ms. Riddle.
I just wanted to point out that one of the biggest barriers to attending meetings for people with disabilities is transportation, the cost of direct support, the loss of wages, and so on. So as you think about this, please think about having the capacity to offer people stipends. Thank you.
Okay. Let me ask this question, and we'll move on from this subject. Let me ask this. And maybe this will get back to when we start looking at some models, but is it, what's the view, I'd like to get your views on whether or not it should be the appointing authority determining whether or not someone continues service on the board, whether it be, you know, for an absence situation or some other for cause matter, or should the board have the authority to be able to say, this person, you know, is, for example, on the absentee issue, this person is not coming to the meetings, and therefore we need to replace this person. Not that the board would necessarily, let's say in a case of someone who was appointed by the county commissioners, obviously they wouldn't appoint their own person. It would be go back to the appointing authority to come back and fill that spot. But what are your thoughts about the board being able to act in a case where they felt they needed to make a change? Ms. Copeland.
The council strongly feels that the board should be empowered to act to invoke any action in regard to lack of attendance. The implications are for the board and for the organization. Therefore, they would know those implications, understand those implications, and should be empowered to act.
Ms. Troutman.
Could it be a combination? It sounds like to me that some of the requirements for attendance are already in the LMEMCO's bylaws, and if in fact you were going with three consecutive absences, could not the board chair send a letter to the appointing authority saying your appointee is in violation of our bylaws, the three consecutive meetings, we ask that you make another appointment. And at that point, then the Board of County Commissioners, if there's appointing authority, or the CFACT or whomever, can talk to their member and find out kind of what's going on. Maybe, in fact, there is an extended illness, and resolve the issue that way rather than one or the other.
Mr. Farmer.
Mr. Chairman, I think the key word there is may. Because there may be some situations where there's extenuating circumstances, and that would, having the word may instead of shall, would give the LME board some leeway in consideration of some extenuating circumstances.
Or I guess, as if I understood it correctly from Mr. Botts, at least at one time, it was shall, and then the discretion part was more along the line of the sufficiency of the excuse. You know, was it a legitimate excuse, you know, or not? And maybe that could be determined by the board. But I do kind of like the concept, frankly, of the board having to make that determination, or somebody having to make that determination that, okay, this absence is because, I mean, you know, somebody's in the hospital, as opposed to, you know, somebody's got a hectic schedule and this is not the highest priority for them. Because, I think you need to resolve those situations. Particularly, it seems to me the larger, and we're trying to figure out, you know, how to get geographic areas represented and all this sort of stuff, that the members that are on there need to be folks who can attend and fulfill the responsibilities, because they're kind of letting a lot of people down if they can't. But anyway, Ms. Weaver.
I agree that the board itself should be empowered to make these decisions. The county commissioners, that would be creating more work for themselves if they had to, you know, decide who gets removed from the board, and then they have to turn around and replace somebody. So they may have a tendency to not follow through because of that.
Senator Tucker.
As I said earlier, I think it should be the responsibility of the board. We're in the land of the offended here, and we don't want to offend anybody, but a politician doesn't want to make anybody mad. an upset. So if the board does it themselves, they don't have the responsibility laid upon them as a politician to make that decision. So the board can do it after three absences, and the board will know whether somebody's been in a hospital or not, or like Commissioner Farmer says, I mean, nobody's going to kick anybody off the board just for the sport of it. But if they have three continued absences, and as Mr. Bott said, the services are not being rendered to the community, something needs to happen, because this is an expensive endeavor for the state. These people need these services, and they need competent adherence to attendance from their board members.
Mr. Cruth, yeah.
Just adding, thinking about as we're going along here, because this is going to apply, I think, when we get talking about the governance makeup in a moment, is what is the model for doing that? Is that thing that's made PBH successful? I know some people may argue that it's not been that successful, but by and large, PBH has been successful in what it's done because of the flexibility that we've got through the waiver. It's been so successful that now the state has said, overall, we've passed legislation, new state law, that we're pushing the waiver down to everyone. So we're giving everybody that flexibility. What we've got to be careful of is outside the fact that, yes, we need to have some stakeholders represented on the board, but we've got to think that same vein is that we're going down to the boards of commissioners, and the boards of commissioners then are going to the programs. If we start making things more restrictive and more directive, and the more descriptive we get at this level, at the state level, on what you can and cannot do, then in essence, it's kind of a paradox we're creating. Whereas if you, I think in this, and just give the flexibility to the boards of commissioners that form that LME, that join that LME, to decide how is the best way it should be governed, how is the best way, you know, within certain parameters that we specify, but leave more flexibility to the local level, to the local board, to address that. And part of that is that the local commissioners want to give authority to the board to remove those members, or the board of commissioners in those that area want to retain control of whether or not a board member is removed, or do they want it to be so that the board contacts the board of commissioners and the board of commissioners does the formal removal after upon recommendation of the area board. So I think those things, I think the more flexibility we give, the less descriptive we get, the better off we're going to be in making it successful, making these waivers, the waivers successful in the local LMEs. And it appreciates the cultural competency too, because everyone's going to be a little bit different the way they, you know, as far as how they're managed and as far as how much their commissioners are involved, how much they want to be involved, and those kind of things in the process.
I think that I shouldn't inject, but I'll inject anyway. I think part of the push, because I understand what you're saying in terms of flexibility, because it's one of those things that you'll, like the senator was talking about, us politicians, we'll say, you know, local control, we'll say that all during the campaign season, and then you get elected and you go about making laws that cut out all the flexibility, you know. So we're guilty of that. But
you are, sir, not me.
Yes, but
I've been here 6 months.
But that's right.
Damage, yeah.
You are only a freshman. Give yourself time. Give yourself time. But the other side of the coin of that, I mean, there is another side to that coin, I think, and the other side of the coin is that from the state's perspective, and this gets back to something was said a moment ago in terms of training and standardization was raised several times by several people, we want to make sure that there's enough of a standardized framework on this, and not to say that you were arguing against that. I don't mean that, but you know, flexibility certainly balanced with the realization that the state's very, very much on the hook and wanting to make sure that, you know, when they're dealing with one MCO, it's not completely different creature when they're dealing with in one part of the state than dealing with the MCO in another part of the state, from the state's aspect perspective of it.
Yes. One point, not to belabor any further, but just one point here about the county commissioners. The board having the authority to remove someone seems to me to be pretty flexible, as opposed to having a elected board try to do it, and we know at sometimes they're reluctant to do it. But the other key factor in the 1915B waiver, isn't the county off the financial hook eventually? So their sense of urgency and their dollars and all those things in there on the front end are not there. Now, I know about the sheriff department and doing all those kind of things that the county should have a vested interest. And if they're elected and they're on that board, then they're elected to serve no matter what board they're appointed to. But the board should be able to have the flexibility to eliminate a county commissioner, whoever doesn't attend three meetings or more, and they've got that flexibility, and that doesn't interfere with the model. I'm fully vested in PBH's model, and we got to make that happen and make it work. But, you know, nobody wants to be held accountable anymore, and everybody wants instantaneous gratification. We don't want to offend anybody, but this is a real opportunity for the state to lose a bunch of money again if this doesn't work.
Ms. Coker.
Something else about flexibility. I think where the flexibility comes in and benefits the community is in how well, of course, the funding gets managed, but mostly in how well the organization listens to its community members so it knows what kind of services it might need to develop to respond to that, to a given community. And so I want to agree with Mr. Carruth that the flexibility is very, very important. But I do think that we've really been bit in the rear for not having more standardization across this state. And I say that as somebody that a lot of consumers and providers have talked to through the years. Thank you.
Any other comments on that? Okay. Well, let's move on from there. I want to go back and we're going to get into some, maybe looking at some models. What we'll probably do is try to cover board composition a little bit and then maybe take a 5-minute break and then come back and we'll put some models up and see where we go on that, see how folks react to some different potential models of appointing. But before we talk about the appointing process per se, I did want to sort of go back over and review, particularly from our last discussion, the types of individuals that we're talking about having a representative representing the board or on the board. We got a lot of different responses last time, great responses. Of course, as you see up there, in terms of a provider ex officio, that's something I think we're going to have to do a little more. That may be problematic, and we'll certainly have the staff do a little more legal work on that to try to nail down what the parameters are there. One that I added, so sort of at chair's discretion, but I did add on there, and hope you would have no objection to it, and that is someone appointed to the board in each of the MCOs by the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. I just think, to me, that's would be very appropriate, and you know, given the department's role, my conception of that is that that individual would not necessarily have to fill any particular category, that we wouldn't be too, in this case, I guess I'm arguing for some flexibility, but obviously the person would have to be from that area and be an appointee of the secretary, but obviously be subject to all of the other restrictions in terms of, with regard to terms of service and attendance and the like. So I added that add that to the list, but let me just open it up. And in terms of the folks that we've got up there, if you've got any comments or folks are saying, "Hey, we're missing something that we had before, or we need to better flesh out what we're talking about here in terms of the types of people, and then we got to figure out, we'll get into the models about maybe how many of whom. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanna share the frame. I went back and read the list. I thought it was a pretty good list that we generated, and then I said, what if I have a human resources approach, like I'm going to be hiring an employee that needs to perform a particular function for those MCOs, and then approaching from that point of view, what do I need to have in that entity? It's not one person, but it's a group, but what do I need to have? Then I said, well, I think we need three levels of representation here. We need a strong representation from business, because we're managing a capitated thing that is going to need some people with financial insurance background. We need that business function. We need a systems expertise. That board is going to have an understanding on the mental health, developmental disabilities, substance abuse, public health, and social services. At the same time, the systems and those fields, you need that expertise. And then you need a community representation in terms of the sensitivity, which is local government, your county commissioners, a local government, consumer representation, families, or community at large. So I thought that you need those three things in the board: business, systems, expertise, and the community representation. And then you could play with that in different ways. If you always think that that entity is going to need to have, when they do deliberations or decisions, you want to balance that then now in those three categories.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ms. Weaver.
I think all the choices are good, and that rather than saying, you know, one person from financial or one person from healthcare, it should be a percentage, because it really is going to depend on how many board members total that you have. I do have one concern, though, about the secretary appointing someone, because the secretary's position is not elected, and it reminds me a little bit too much of Big Brother sticking their hand into our local business.
The only I'll tell you my thinking on that. And my thinking on that is that the state, and we've kind of come back and talked about it on several occasions, and under the situation, we say the MCOs are at risk, and I don't want to necessarily say they're not at risk, but the truth is the state's at risk. And so I just think that it's because the state is at risk, and it's, you know, so much of the money that's in there, I mean, additional to the federal money, is a lot of state money, millions and tens of millions of dollars of state money in there, that it's good to have somebody that, and the secretary, believe me, if anything goes wrong, they always go back to the secretary of the department, and that's the person that's, you know, they're the appointee of the governor, and they're responsible for all the fires, whether they started them or not. And that's sort of usually the thing. And they're usually very, very, I mean, they're the normal one that would make that kind of appointment, and, you know, in part so that the secretary can have a better feel for that there's a connection between the secretary and what's going on in each MCO area. And, you know, to a certain extent, that person can relay some information back to the secretary, a feel from on the ground as to how operations are going. And, you know, assuming that everything goes well, but in case if you've got some area where it looks like they're headed towards some problems or issues or concerns, the secretary can maybe know about it a little bit ahead of time and can work on that problem before, when it's a smaller problem, and before it gets to be a big problem.
And I can certainly understand that. However, if the department has proper oversight, I would hope that wouldn't be necessary.
Good point.
I just wanted to add, I personally think it's a great idea, because there is a level of knowledge sharing that would be happening that doesn't happen now with a state, if the secretary is appointing somebody and that person knows he's kind of to represent DHHS and then I think that the kind of information that gets shared is just going to, in the long run, be more transformational as we're making all these changes anyway. But the other issue is, until some language is changed, sometimes, you know, it's real easy for the counties to say, well, it's the state's problem, and the state to say it's the county's problem, and the LME is always saying it's the state's problem. And if we have a state-appointed person on the board, that'll help close that circle so that everybody involved will share accountability. Does that make any sense? What's been frustrating for us at the community level is, if we take an issue to the places that are supposed to help us, ultimately everybody says we need to talk to somebody else because we don't really have that authority. And I think one way to help be sure that authority and that accountability gets shared, and I mean shared because it's public, then would be to have somebody that is representing that's been appointed by the state and that answers somewhat to the state too, in ensuring that information is flowing well among all the people involved. Because the big fear right now across the state is that the state is leaving itself out. It's kind of maneuvering things to where it's too much in the hands of MCOs, and it doesn't feel safe to people. It just doesn't feel safe right now. So I think that could help.
Okay. I will say this is kind of an aside to what you're saying. We certainly want to come out of this with a system that is fully accountable and feels fully accountable from the MCO level and the local level and from the state's perspective. Because if anybody in the chain, so to speak, is not diligent in their responsibilities, we'll have problems more than, you know, the normal ones. But Ms. Troutman.
I would want to clarify that for the county commissioner, it could instead be the county manager, because I want to be real careful and not displace what's working now. I know that we all pledge the fidelity to the PBH model, but there has to be a flavor of the board composition from one MCO to another. And I'm thinking of the Western Highlands, which I think was our second one to come online in terms of meeting all the waiver requirements. And that board is, in terms of the appointees coming from the county, comprised of county managers. You get the connection back to the community, you get the connection back to the county government, but you also get the management and financial expertise that those managers bring to bear too. So again, one thing that I would like to emphasize, anything that we're considering here and changes that we're considering here, not displace the successes we already have working out there. Thank you.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying, you would sort of put county commissioner / county manager. Is that a Ms. Weaver?
I would just like to know how many boards out there right now have all county managers on them besides Western Highlands, and also point out the fact that they aren't elected people, so they could basically be on there for life. And again, I don't think that's fair to the other board members.
Yeah. Well, I would. That gets back to the terms. And somebody tell me if my thinking is wrong, but I think that what we will end up with is that everyone who serves on there, irrespective of how they are appointed, is going to end up having to be under the same set of parameters in terms of how many terms they could serve.
And I don't have a problem with that if that's the way it is, but right now at the Western Highlands Board, the county managers are on there as long as they're employed, but the other board members are not. They're limited to terms.
Gotcha.
They're on there as long as the appointing authority agrees that they should represent the interests of the counties and the communities. And again, one would think that Western Highlands is showing some success if they are the second one in line to implement the waiver procedure. And I would not want to displace the successes we already have out there for some composition that may not work for Western Highlands.
Ms. Coke.
Through the years, advocates in the Western Highlands area have been real frustrated that it's comprised the way it is. And, you know, they don't have much voice in it. Obviously, they can't really leverage anything through an appointed county person. And it also makes you wonder, you know, it makes you feel like that your county commissioners are kind of shirking a responsibility they should have to their communities. So I just wanted to support what Rosemary is saying. It's been a concern for years for the people in those communities.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to see if Victoria Witt was here today. When I talked with her the other day, she said that our eight counties, our county commissioners do attend. And as I said, we have two that are going from Randolph County. And one's the chair of the commissioners and the other is a member. And that has worked well. County managers, I don't know. These two people have expertise and they've gone all over the county to learn about stuff like this. So I think county commissioners who represent so many people would be better than the county manager. Thank you.
Other. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Tucker.
I did want to note that, as Ms. Troutman knows, in my county, on a more jovial note, in Union County, it's not a problem with the county manager. We get one every 2 years. Every election cycle.
More stability in the mountains, maybe. That's, Mr. Boss.
Yeah, it strikes me we have LMEs taking on additional responsibilities, and now we're on this discussion of board composition, and I'm hearing people talk about county commissioners, county managers, and consumers and family members. We've had those people on the board for a long time, and I think we have those people represented on this body. So obviously people on this body and who are representing those folks are advocating for that to continue, and that's fine, and I think that's good. But I mean, I think one of the reasons we're here is to, and when we come to talk about board composition, is what do we need that we don't have now given the new role? And I would like to hear, I mean, for my benefit, for the committee's benefit, my benefit, you know, what Ms. Shipman might have to say about that, who's been operating this waiver for a while. I'd like to know what the department thinks about that, what the division thinks about that. I'm sure there are people who have thought about this, and any others. So I think it's good to hear from consumers and from folks representing counties and county commissioners. They're strong advocates of continuing those people being on the board, and I think it's a good thing. But what do we need in addition to that? That's what I would like to hear about, given the emerging role of LMEs going into the managed care organization role.
Ms. Shipman, you want to respond to that?
You know, I think the best chance the system has for accountability is to have strong LME boards. And I think that part of that, and I think this list is great. I would suggest that there would be a number of members on the board that have these specialty expertise, because I think that they will serve to educate other members of the board who may or may not, you know, have that background. But it's another way. If the only information the board gets is from the CEO, you know, you really don't have a board that can hold the CEO accountable. And so if you have a board that has, you know, stakeholders and consumers, but also, you know, equal numbers of other individuals who do understand the business model, you have a much better chance of, you know, having balance and having a board that, you know, can inform itself and, you know, hold the organization and CEO accountable. So, you know, we don't need weak boards as we go into this. We need boards that understand the business model. And, you know, that doesn't mean every single person, but certainly a significant number of the members should be experts, you know, in business, insurance, whatever. I mean, this list is fine. But I think that those people are going to be critical to informing other members of the board and also in terms of managing, you know, the organization. So that's kind of my thoughts.
Yes. Dr. Melcher.
Thank you. You know, I think this is a great list, and I, you know, we certainly want to have stakeholders represented on the boards. But I think in terms of the new expertise, we really need to have folks who can ask the right questions around business and management. These are entities now that are managing huge sums of money. And for them to be successful, we need to have folks who know the questions to ask and who have maybe had experience in managing risk, in managing corporations that handle large amounts of money. I think it's just in the best interest of that MCO board to have that expertise there. One category that I see, I don't think it would be a requirement, but maybe helpful, is someone with a legal background. There are a lot of questions that come up around contracts, appeals, grievances, that sort of thing. And not that the board doesn't have its own attorney, but again, in the same vein, it would be nice to have people who can ask the questions.
Okay, we'll add that to the list, legal.
Mr. Chairman, one thing to suggest, again, back on the idea of maximum flexibility, is that I think Spots made that point a while ago, is that we already have represented on there the communities, the consumers, and the commissioners, and I think that we do need to add a legal slash business, or business slash legal, whatever where you want to put it in. But if you just, it's very simple. If you take the board size, whatever it is, divide it by one third, and one third are commissioners, one third are, you know, have somebody that is there, their expertise is because they're a consumer, family member of a consumer, a provider, and then another third are folks with the business legal expertise to manage a large organization. And I think you just specify that, then within that, you can have ways you develop so that people are nominated and they fill one of those roles. And that way you always are balancing that out. Over time, it will balance itself out so that as you replace board members and you're lacking people on there that are, you know, are consumers or family members of consumers, then you can ensure the next appointee from whatever county will have that expertise coming onto the board. And it, over time, it'll work its way out. But as long as you maintain it, one-third division. And then you may have some folks that may have dual expertise, that may be a business expert, but also be a family member and have a family member that is a consumer that can fill both roles.
Ms. Riddle.
Thank you, Commissioner. You make my point. My own board, the Council on Developmental Disabilities, we're quite thoughtful in appointing families and consumers. We have family members who are physicians, who are attorneys. We have people with disabilities who are business people and so on. So I very much appreciate, Ms. Shipman, the complexity of the business model. At the same time, I really think it's imperative that we represent in a robust fashion the constituency that these organizations serve.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Simmons.
I can't count the number of MHD DSA companies going out of business in the last few years. So an important role of the board is to make sure that the constituents that they work with have an opportunity to survive, and that depends on a lot of policy issues flow through the board that will have a direct impact on provider community, which ultimately has a direct impact on the consumer community. Because as these companies go out of business, there's a lot of disruption in their lives. So if it's not legally tenable to have a provider on the board, that's a shame, but that may be the way it is. And the second point I want to make relative to the provider community is if we need one thing, we need, and I know I'm getting into the weeds and Pam will stick me in the leg in a minute, we need consistency, we need statewideness, we need predictability. And in order to get that, you need someone that helps remind the board as they're working through their many challenges that they're going to face, they're going to be many. But for this to be successful, it's really an important partnership relationship between consumers, families, the MCO and the provider community, because the MCO is now the funding source, and the flow of funds are going to make all the difference in what services are provided, and to work closely with the provider community is just essential in getting the job done and having a system that we're not going to have to rebuild again in the future. We need something that's going to be stable, for particularly for the consumers. So thank you.
Mr. Farmer.
Mr. Chair, we've talked on the negative aspect of county commissioners being on the board. Let me be positive for a moment. I have a commissioner on my board who is a CPA, another commissioner who's a declared consumer. And my area director will tell you that we have several county commissioners who call on a regular basis, if not complaining, but checking on why are certain clients not getting services or why services not where they should be or are needed. So county commissioners are engaged. I have two county commissioners that rarely never come to a meeting, but I have a dozen that are fully engaged and attend every meeting. So I'd like to say that, to say that let's not leave the commissioners out. As I look at Model 2 and 3 there, you have less commissioner representation. That the commissioners are elected by the people, and the people know, and any commissioner will tell you, they know who to call. And they'll call you in a heartbeat when something is not getting done. And I'm afraid if we get too few commissioners and people who are not as well-known in the community on the board, they won't know who to call. They'll call the commissioner, and then the commissioner will have to call somebody else to find out who they need to lodge their concern with. So I would just caution us to be careful about limiting the number of commissioners.
We'll take a, if you don't mind, I'll tell you what we'll do. We put the, with the objection of the senator noted, we added the possibility of having legal expertise on the board as a possibility there. But I think that if I'm understanding everybody correctly, we've at least have up there the kinds of expertise, the types of people that we want composing the board. Now we got to get into, okay, how does that fit and how many, and as Commissioner Farmer said, okay, how do we actually sort out that model? What I would like to do is take just a 5-minute break and come back at 5 till 4. All right. We'll reconvene at 5 till 4. So 6 minute, just a quick 6-minute break. If you need to get some water or use the restroom or what have you, and then what I want to do is get in and look at some models that we have and get some feedback on those on which ones you think may be heading down the right direction and which ones you have some concerns about. All right. So with that, we're recessed for 6 minutes. The committee would come back to order. You got an idea? Okay, I think we've got everybody. We've got everybody back. In the legislature, 5 minutes is always 10. That's just the way it works. So, sorry about that. But what I thought I would do, or what we've done, and hopefully that we can, we've done some preparatory work that can make this constructive. We'll soon find out. But what we've lined out are three possible models. We're not necessarily wedded to these. We could come up with something different. But three potential models that what we want to kind of do is just sort of I want to turn it over for a moment to our committee consultant, Pat Porter, who has years and years and years of expertise in these issues under many different headings to sort of explain the three, and then what we want to do is allow these sort of be a launch. You get a feel for which of these models might be more closely aligned to what the committee thinks would better serve, and then if we can find a consensus around a particular framework, we can obviously go, we'll, you know, work further in terms of refining that and making that what we want. If we find that we don't have any of these three models that the committee thinks really serves it, then we'll, you know, have to drop back and look at something else. But we at least want to put up some frameworks. This is not everything that would be in these models, but these are designed to be more general in nature, and because we've got to start somewhere with some type of framework, and then add the come back and add the detail to it that we've already been discussing now for the last couple of hours. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Porter to explain these three models, and then we'll get into a discussion.
Thank you. I'll begin by saying that these three models didn't come out of nowhere. They you were invited to submit questions, comments, criticisms last time, and many of you did submit that information. And these models basically are a reflection of information that we received from members of this committee. A good place to start, I think, from that perspective. I'll go through these briefly. You've got them in front of you on the second sheet of your handout. The first one is Model 1, and it prescribes the maintenance of the process as currently provided in 122C 118.1, which basically is that the county commissioners make the appointment of all members. Now, the thing that we've added here, however, we've added two things. The first thing is that they would be consistent, the appointments would be consistent with the size and the composition requirements that we just discussed. Okay? So while the county commissioners will appoint, they must do that within the constraints of the list of those that you have said should be on the board, and within the size that we've discussed. That was the intent of this. And we would add one member to the current list, and that would be the secretary's appointment. We talked about having one member appointed by the secretary. So that's Model 1, sort of a status quo, although with the constraints that we've discussed. The second model is one that was discussed by Commissioner Carruth a minute ago, I think it was you, and that was the one-third, one-third, one-third model. Basically, within the size constraints and with acknowledgement that there will be a list of members that must be appointed, one-third will be, and this is the numbers on these are based upon a size of 21. That's what we came up with based on this. Let's say that we determined that you could have no more than 21 members on the board. Then one-third of those, or up to seven, would be appointed by the county commissioners. The second group, one-third, would be comprised of consumers, families, providers, professionals from the constituent local management entities, that is those local management entities that make up the LME MCO. And that would be up to six, plus a provider who, in our conception, would be an ex officio non-voting member. Finally, one-third would be comprised of those individuals appointed by the sitting governance board, up to seven. We've had some discussion about who would those be. Those would likely be the group represented by the different expertise that were listed in those composing the board. And again, we've added one local appointment by the secretary. That's Model 2, one-third, one-third, one-third. Model 3 is a little more complex, but related to Model 2. Each constituent LME would be directed to establish a community oversight board, or a COB, with a defined set of responsibilities. This group would have on it CFAC chair, 3 members from each constituent county appointed by the county commission, to include commissioner or manager, consumer, family member, or other stakeholder. This COB would participate in the appointment to the governance board. The LME MCO governance board then is comprised of one representative from each community oversight board, 2 at-large county commissioners, 1 representative from the LME MCO regional CFAC, and 6 members with special expertise. These would be originally appointed by the secretary of the department, and then the board, a committee of the governing board, would recruit for vacancies to the board as they occur, given the term limits. And then the governing board would vote for those replacements. So this gives the local management entities, each of which have membership in the LME MCO. This gives them significant control in who is appointed to the governance board. So you have Model 1, which is what we've got now within the size and composition constraints. That is, the county commissioners appoint. We have Model 2, which is one-third, one-third, one-third model. One-third appointed by commissioners, one-third consumers, families, providers, and professionals, one-third sitting appointed by the sitting governing board, and 1 local appointment by the secretary. And then you have Model 3, which is each constituent LME establishes a community oversight board. And that board, by the way, would have its own list of responsibilities. This is a model that's currently being proposed, I think, by PBH, and there may be other LMEs that are looking at that kind of representation now. So perhaps we can get some input from others of this group on that. Any questions about those 3?
Yeah, what we'll do first here is just take some clarifying questions in terms of the details of these models, and then we can kind of branch off of that. So if the first set of questions could be more just sort of clarifying what these models are, and then we get into what's good, bad, and different about those, if we can do that. So, Ms. Weaver? Ms. Troutman?
Thank you. I just would like an explanation about how the idea of a constituent LME applies to Western or Centerpoint or Smoky Mountain, how that would apply to them as a constituent LME. Would they be the entirety as opposed to the merger in some of the other areas? I mean, how does the constituent LME apply to those who have been at the same size and the same composition for several years?
Are you talking about single county representation? You're talking about merged counties? I'm not understanding the question.
And I apologize. Let me try to be clear. When I see Model 3, each constituent LME establishes a community oversight board. What is meant by constituent LME?
The LMEs that were once LMEs.
And my question
are merging.
And my question is, for those who have been in the same composition for a number of years, how do you treat that as a constituent LME? Would that be the entirety of Smoky Mountain? Would that be half of Smoky Mountain? Same for Western. They're not a merged or a merger. They've been in that composition for several years, so how would they be treated as constituent LME?
Are they merging together into an MCO?
No.
Who will be the MCO?
The LME has become the MCO. And so they haven't changed their composition. There aren't any constituent LMEs except for that existing one.
Okay, I get you. Would you like to respond to that? You got some ideas, I think.
Yeah, the group that our committee worked on it, this is really just, if it was already a large LME, would be, you know, groups of counties that would form regions under the LME. So right now we have four LMEs that are coming together, so we just kind of grouped it that way. But the idea would be that with so many counties, you know, we would have regions and operations centers in each region. So my thought would be that if this was a long-time existing LME with lots of counties, they would just set up regions within their catchment.
Ms. Wheaton.
And my question was just a clarification. There will only be one representative from the COB, similar to what Rebecca's asking. So, for instance, Smoky Mountain and Western Highlands, would you be talking about one person from every county then, if that's how they set up their COBs?
And there's three from every county in this model at the oversight board level.
Because it says here one representative from each COB.
That's on the governance board. Each community oversight board would elect a member to the governance board. Anybody, could be CFAC, could be a consumer, could be a family member, could be a commissioner. You know, but those boards would elect, each of them would elect a member to the governance board.
Thanks, Ben.
Though it's not prescribed in statute, if with Model 1, LME board or ordinary citizens could still make recommendations to county commissioners of individuals that might be suitable, right?
Right.
Thanks.
Ms. Rubin.
Thanks. Am I correct, Dr. Porter, that in Model 3 it's possible to have to come out with only one consumer representative, the CFAC, potentially?
I think that's right.
You know me, that would be a concern.
In regards to Model 3, my assumption is that the LME / MCO has the flexibility to establish how many COBs that they want within their regional structure, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Just for the record, my own board is established under federal law, and I realize it's established for very different purposes, but 60% of it are families and individuals. And I would so like to see in one of these models or in any model that we choose that minimally that we have an adult consumer from mental health to developmental disabilities and substance abuse, three distinct. The family member, I think, potentially could be a family member either of an individual who is a minor or a guardian of an individual.
Ms. Kirk.
I just think it could be a real misstep for management not to have a sizable number of people with lived experience of having illness, addiction, or developmental disability, and especially if they have the experience of having recovered from them, because they know what works and what doesn't in the system. I mean, and as far as the application of the models of care, et cetera. And this is why, you know, in a lot of other states, there is so much more consumer involvement, not because it's just a human rights issue, and it is, nothing about us without us, but it makes good business sense. And I just really think, you know, a couple of these models, there's an assumption that other folks really know what's going on in people's lives, and I don't want to devalue the personal knowledge people have accumulated through their experience. And I know a lot of people have started out in places where they've had experiences here and there with folks, but you know, there are things that work in our lives and there are things that don't. And the best way to use that responsive flexibility that a waiver has is to ensure that you're getting feedback from people who use it. And to me, every LME should be having COBs, no matter what kind of governance you do. It scares me to think that they don't. It scares me that my LME only has the CFAC serving on all the little committees that it's developed. And we have a mental health collaborative with 35 people attending whose input is not, you know, tapped. And we've been meeting for 4 years. But there needs to be community input and there needs to be consumer input if you really want it to work. And yes, we've got some terrible gaps in how things have been managed with the Medicaid dollars. I understand from a lot of providers that a lot of that has to do with Medicaid itself in our state and all the rules we've set up around that. It may not be just an LME or local management issue. But if we're going to really make it better, you just have to include the customers in every process.
Well, let me, okay, let's shift the discussion then from, and Dr. Porter's not going very far. that's a comfort to me, but. but let's get some discussion. I guess we were already kind of getting into it, but on these three different models, your reactions to them, what you like, what you don't like, and I think Commissioner Carruth is ready to comment, so we'll let him lead off on
that. Well, I wanted to just clarify, too, the model. I was talking about one third thing a while ago, but I think important because of the tie back to the elected official is that even if you go with, I think, Model 2, which, you know, it has some merit there with the one third thing, and even though with PBH, I know it's got the COB thing on that board, so... That also has stuff, but I think what you look at is that we're looking at them as three mutually exclusives of each other, but the tie's got to be back. I think that you should have a nominating process, and I think it needs to be clear that the final authority, even if it's just symbolic, the final approval is a vote by an elected board of commissioners. And so you can break it down, Model 2 or Model 3 to 1, but it still comes back that their legal appointment comes from the member county in which they're resident of. That way you've got that tie back to the elected body, and it's acting under, you know, that tie there. So even if you do nominate, they're nominated, and you can provide a list of names. And Model, what I was talking about a while ago is that our county and our Convention and Visitors Bureau, we have the Bureau Board itself every year submits three names to Board of Commissioners. The local Chamber of Commerce submits three names to the Board of Commissioners, and the Board of Commissioners then can appoint from another person. But there's three people appointed, but the Board of Commissioners is obligated to appoint off that list of nominees. In other words, we can't just reach out. If the Chamber sends us three names, we can't just reach out and grab somebody else and put them in that Chamber slot. And it's the same thing here. You still could do that. You just were saying we're going to nominate. Those names would be nominated, but the final approval authority would be from that board within that particular county where that person resides at.
Other comments?
I have a question for Mr. Carruth. So, I'm trying to see what you would think the advantage of Model 2 over Model 1 is. Is that one third of the appointments made by a separate group other than the county commissioners would have to be. The county could not select from outside of the ones that you guys would put forth, for instance, if you were, like, on the LME board? I mean, otherwise, what's the real difference? If the LME director is tasked with working well with community stakeholders, community leadership, because they want to achieve the end of the best services for the least amount of funding, it would seem like the board would have a relationship just like ordinary citizens with the county commissioners, just to make the recommendations of who they want. And if that was the case, it would just seem like staying with Model 1 but really clarifying responsibilities would work. What's the difference between Model 2 and Model 1 for you?
What I'm seeing is that Model 1 could be implemented in Model 2 or Model 3, because all you're saying is that you would have a nomination process that would be established by the LME. So the LME would still nominate from the constituent LMEs, would still have a nomination process of where if you wanted to serve on the board, you would go through, you know, you submit the application to the LME. The LME would review it. They would determine, you know, this person would best fit in, and we recommend this person, put them on a recommended list that then would go to the, you know, the particular board of commissioners for the county where the person resides, and then they, when that slot came up, they would, the board of commissioners then would appoint from that list. So if you had five people that, you know, they we would choose between those five people that the LME reviewed and endorsed and sends a nomination to that particular board of commissioners.
This very issue right now has been a real problem historically in some LMEs, that it kind of got to where, well, in fact, in our community, without the county realizing it, some changes happened to where you had to apply through the LME director. And that kind of turns everything all upside down, because it's kind of the fox picking out who's going to be in his or her hen house. And I won't go into all the details of it, but part of why we like county commissioners being involved is because, number one, by the pressure that constituents put on them to learn and understand these issues, they will learn and understand these issues if they want to be reelected. But we have no other voice outside of that. And sometimes what you have is, and I'm sorry I'm having to speak from the glass half empty perspective, but if we don't protect us from the glass half empty, we could end up with a lot of half empty glasses and find that it's just going to be rare and few than when you have the better LME management situations. So I'm just trying to say that we have to safeguard the taxpayers' voice and the voice of the system, the people that have to lean on that system. And it seems to me the only one that really, really maximally does that is Model 1, because that way we all have access to the elected officials who are tasked with making those appointments.
Now, let me do this so that did you have something particular you
want to add that? And I think that you could build something like that in where, say, one-third were from consumer families, you could also, the Board of Commissioners would retain a, say, one-third that would be appointed at large. So that would allow that access straight through. So if it didn't come through the nomination process from the LME, it would come through, you know, directly to, they could take those nominations directly. So you would have, you know, that it would be balanced out, but you would have that avenue by which somebody could come and apply directly to be appointed as an at-large position in that county.
I want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly.
I'm starting to get more confused myself now.
No.
What would happen is, say you had one-third every year of the board that was appointed. You may not have from any county, one year they may not have anybody they appoint, but the next year they may have an opening that comes up from their county. And what you do then is that would be looked at, well, what is needed on the board to continue to balance it out? Do we need somebody that's a consumer or a family member of a consumer, or do we need somebody with business expertise? And those names would be provided to that board of commissioners from the LME of, here's folks that have been expressing interest in serving. Because that's what we do now. I mean, I've when we appoint a replacement, I was always, and it was Pam's predecessor, I was always calling our area director saying, do we have somebody right now that's expressed an interest from our county in serving? And that's what kind of used to determine, you know, who we would put on that board.
Well, let me just ask you one clarifying question, then I want to see if Ms. Chipman wouldn't mind talking about, I think Model 3 is the one that you have an interest in, or y'all are working toward, I guess, in a certain extent. On the Model 2, just so I'm understanding it correctly, the one-third that would be appointed, well, that would be or could be appointed by the board itself, you're saying that your conception of that, if you did it that way, that the board would not necessarily make the direct appointment. You still want it to go back to whatever county the particular individual came from for a blessing by that that county's board of commissioners.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay, so it would go back, right, and that final appointment would come from that board of commissioners, okay, even though it was nominated or maybe from a list of names that were provided by the LME. Of folks that would, that they felt would be.
A list of names, or maybe one name.
It may be one name, but we could specify that you would have maybe, you know, three names would be submitted, that three to four names, and they would decide, the board would decide which one to appoint from that list.
Okay. Well, let me. I won't pursue that anymore at the moment. But Ms. Shipman.
We had, this came from a work group. We had about three people from each of the four LME boards and the CFAC chair from each LME. And, you know, what our idea is, you know, we want to have an oversight board at the local level, regardless of governance, that we had already decided we wanted to have that board that would be looking at local issues, local concerns, you know, local performance indicators that related to that so-called sub-region or whatever you want to call it. And so, you know, we're really leaving in place the historical LME, you know, groupings of counties, because those counties generally have worked together for a long time and they have, you know, a lot of established relationships. And so this oversight board that would function, you know, would be appointed by the commissioners, because we really think that that connection back to the county commissioners is important, and the commissioner could either choose, they could choose for one of them to serve, or they could choose to appoint somebody. It wouldn't be required that the commissioners serve, but if they wanted to serve, they certainly could. And so these oversight boards, you know, we see as very important in terms of quality and community satisfaction and, you know, being able to make sure we're in touch with local issues regardless of governance. However, you know, the idea is then that each of these regional oversight boards that are not governing boards, they really are, you know, looking at performance indicators or giving advice. They're, you know, helping to evaluate the executive director that has those counties and, you know, have a very important role. But they would choose, vote on someone that would go to the governance board. That's totally out of the control of the area director or anybody else. And then our CFACs have already come together and decided to form a regional CFAC. And so that group would also appoint someone to the board, so that you kind of have, you know, what's that for us would be five people that are, you know, absolutely coming from the community and are based on community priorities. And then we would have, you know, the six people with expertise, and then you have the one with the appointment by the secretary. So, you know, our model is kind of based on the idea of having these regions that are right now in the shape of the historical LMEs, where they, you know, we will have an office where we want to have an oversight board, you know, that is connected to the community in the same way that the LME boards are now. And so we use that as kind of a feeder up to the governance board. So that's kind of the thinking that we had behind our model. And we've just met, well, we've met a number of times trying to just put the finishing touches on it. And, you know, we're just going to go back to our boards. It has not done that yet, to kind of have further discussion and vetting. But this is just kind of a model of, you know, trying to, you know, keep the best of what we have now in terms of community linkages and, you know, mold that into a meaningful regional governance system. So that's kind of the background there.
Okay, I want to, if I might indulge, if the department would indulge me, I want to get the department's reaction to these models and, you know, y'all's professional opinion, shall we say, on what you think might work best, or you may want to phrase it in terms of what advantages you see in certain models and what other models you might say, well, there are advantages here, but there are concerns there.
Well, having just seen some of these, I'm still sort of mulling through this. The department doesn't have a position. I will say I think that we are here
because there have been concerns around Model 1, especially as we grow and we have a different structure being placed, the MCO structure being placed. I think Model 1 becomes harder, I think. Model 3, we have heard PBH talk about it. I think there is interest in that, especially as counties are merging together. It gives an opportunity to kind of maintain what a lot of communities are concerned about, which is losing their identity as the mergers occur. And so I think Model 3 gives the opportunity for that to continue and to have more of a local representation on that larger board. Model 2, today's the first time I've heard that model. I think that's almost a compromise between 1 and 3 as a way to have categories of representation on these new boards. So I think, you know, I think that that's another model to look at, but I think Model 3, just probably maybe because I know more about it, I think addresses a lot of concerns that have been raised around how local communities are going to keep their identity.
Mr. Hedrick.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could direct a question to Ms. Shipman, please.
Yes, sir.
Pam, if you can help me understand, I'm just trying to be sure I understand that I'm counting right. When you say you would have one representative from each community oversight board. So you'd have one from your traditional PBH community oversight board, and you'd have one from, just to get specific so I can, concrete so I can understand, one from Alamance-Caswell, one from Five County, one from OPC. That's four. Is that, am I understanding your intent? And of those community oversight boards, they could, they would have a representative, and that representative can come from any nature, any manner of groups within that community. It could be, if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, we have.
Would, but the total number, as I understand it, by your current model would be 15. Is that right? 4 plus 4 plus 6 plus 1, if I'm counting up right? I just want to be sure I'm understanding what your intent is, if you can comment. Thank you.
It comes up to 13 and 14 with the appointment by the secretary. You know, we, of course, we have a lot of details in the model, which I didn't try to, you know, submit. But what we have thought, what our idea is, that we would ask each county to appoint one consumer or family, one other stakeholder, and either a commissioner or another representative, so that in a five-county area you would have 15 members plus the CFAC chair from that for that area, so that would be 16. In a three-county area, you would have, 10 members? You know, and each of those would select one member that would go up to the governance board. We have a lot more fleshed out, you know, again, in terms of the mechanics, but, you know, the idea is to just tie it back to each of the historical communities and also to the counties and the county commissions, so that, you know, counties that want to be very, very involved have that option, and, you know, those that are comfortable having another representative, you know, have that option as well.
If I may follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
please. Pam, so the one representative from each COB, that would be, right now that would be four representatives that you would have. As you've heard me say, it's important from the people I represent that we have the expertise, the business understanding, somewhere assured in the group. And I don't see that on here. I guess it could be one of the representatives from the COB, but then again, it might not be. Or do you see some provider skill sets, so to speak, being in the six members that you propose?
The six members are obviously the expertise. This group did not specifically name providers in that subset. You know, I don't. You know, but that might be where that would be, you know, if it turns out that's an okay thing to do. But they really were focused on having the minority be those with expertise and the majority being those that somehow come up from the local level, but yet having enough members with special expertise to, you know, so that you have this mutual benefit of stakeholders and experts coming together to govern, you know, the LME.
Can I ask just one follow-up on that? So I think you said this, and I wasn't picking up on it, but what's your sort of rough breakdown then? You've got your governance board at the top level would be four would be coming from the COBs, the one each from those counties, and then what are the balance of those 13 members?
Boy, this button's there'd be four from the community oversight boards, one person from the regional CFAC, two commissioners at large, six members with some kind of expertise as outlined there, and then with the someone appointed by the secretary, that would make it 14 instead of 13.
And then the six members that would be come with the expertise, who would be coming up with those names?
We had the way we had it was maybe initially they would be appointed by the secretary or somebody, and then after that the board would have a subcommittee that would propose members, and that the board would vote on those specialty members of the board.
A nominating committee of the board.
Right. A nominating committee that would go out and search and say, oh, we need someone with insurance background. Let's try to find a nominee for that. You know, or if we needed someone that, you know, if we need a physician or if we needed, you know, some other type of expertise, that committee would go out and solicit potential members.
Ms. Riddle.
Again, acknowledging the complexity of running one of these organizations, I'm still going to hold out that a third of this group of people should be the primary stakeholders, families, and individuals with developmental disabilities, mental health, and substance abuse needs. I would also argue that at least one of them should come from each of those particular areas. They are very, very distinct. I have yet to see the developmental disabilities community feel comfortable turning over its representation to the mental health or the substance abuse community and vice versa. I see that particularly because, as we all know, there has been an enormous resistance from consumers and families, particularly in the developmental disabilities community, to the 1915 BC waiver. I think by making sure that the constituency itself is represented, you get more buy-in. Secondly, I think it's important to acknowledge that at this point in the field, this is very much part of the culture that we work in. Again, Ms. Coker said nothing about us without us. I cannot imagine. I'm going to have to get under this desk if we come out of here with a composition that potentially has only one individual who represents all three of those constituencies on it. Thank you, sir.
Let me just mention a couple things on that. I think that in all of these models, like I say, this, you know, these are frameworks, and we could certainly adjust, or at least I think we could adjust any of these frameworks to make sure that we wouldn't end up with that type of scenario. And but beyond that, if I could ask you just a quick question. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'll do it anyway. Are any of these three models, or which of these three models do you have a particular preference for, or is it none of the above, or which one's more to your?
It would be model three, because it places the governance closest to the people from my point of view.
Okay. Ms. Weaver.
I'd like to ask Mr. Botts to clarify the legality of these three models, particularly Model 1, because someone had mentioned they thought Model 1 was the best, but I believe, Mark, you had said at our first meeting that there were two options under the current statute, and one was all county commissioners, and the other one was whatever you want as long as everybody agreed. And if we're going to end up going back to Model 1, then we don't really need to be here.
Yep. Respondent.
So what is the question then? So, the, I mean, Model 1 is it's the current statute, as I understand it, so there will still be, well, unless... My understanding is that how it's been articulated, Model 1 is the current statute except with new compositional requirements and one appointment by the secretary. However, I see that Model 1 says county commissioners appoint all members. Under the current statute, county commissioners can come up with a different method of appointment. So I'm not sure if Model 1 is... I'm not sure what was intended here, Pat, and maybe you could. So, are we saying maintain process as current? There's a consistency between the first two statements there.
To kind of help you with that analysis, let's Dr. Porter, could you kind of flesh that out?
Yes, the intention was this that Model 1 was consistent with the current statute. And it should have been either that county commissioners appoint or county commissioners make the decision that there's another mechanism for appointment. It's still the authority still resides for appointment still resides with the county commissioners. They either appoint directly or they make a decision about how to appoint.
So if that's helpful. So Model 1 is essentially the same process, but you add an appointment from the secretary, and there's some additional compositional requirements that must be met. That's how I understand it. I'm not sure if that answers your question completely, but.
Well, I just wanted everyone to understand if we're talking about Model 1 that it does give that option for the county commissioners to come up with some other formula, and. Not necessarily just the county commissioners, and I didn't understand the intent of this, because that's how some LMEs have ended up with all county managers on their board of directors, because the county commissioners all got together and said that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah, I guess I would add, it seems to me that under the current statute, if it were not amended, that Model 3 would be permissible. I don't know that you have to change the statute for Model 3 to occur. You have to change the statute if you want to require Model 3 to occur. And the other thing is about consumers and family members. Model 1 does not, unless the compositional requirements are changed accordingly, Model 1 does not require any consumers or family members.
Mr. Jordan.
Yeah, one of the points that I would make as you look at this, and correct me if I'm wrong, Pam, with five county OPC, Alamance, Castle, and then the five counties that represent PBH as they currently stood, your community oversight boards would have a representation of 45 people that would start at the local level, of which would build up, because if you have at the COB level, you would have three members from each county appointed by the county on these COBs. That starts with 45 people. That's a huge amount of local representation of which you're pulling up to this executive or this governance board. That's even more representation than I think folks have right now in the decision-making in the LME process or the MCO process. And I think that gets back to what the department was wanting to do with, you know, the maintenance of the localness of the LME structure as we overlay the MCO responsibilities into this new framework of which we're going to be delivering services.
Ms. Trout.
In revisiting our charge and returning to our discussion at our first meeting, our charge was really to be ready to propose some new options for the short session of the General Assembly to remove any barriers for our LMEs moving to waivers to be successful. And also, at our last discussion, there was a lot of discussion. Mark mentioned that option two of current statutory language allowed the participating counties to organize the board, like either two or three if they so chose, any way they saw fit, as long as there was 100% consensus. And it was my understanding that some of the concerns about that was getting 100% consensus, because there was some discussion about a supermajority. Again, I would kind of emphasize that we don't want to displace the successes that we're already having. I wouldn't want to tell Sandhills, hey, even though you're working, now you're going to have to displace your board and establish a Model 3. At the same point, if, in fact, PBH believes, because they're combining four different LMEs, is that correct, Pam? That's very different than any of the other configurations. So they're combining four separate and apart LMEs, and they're going to maintain those as constituent LMEs through this model. But again, if that is something that they think is going to work for them, I would say let's go forward, as long as we don't say, oh, Smoky, you have to do that, Mecklenburg, you have to do that, and Western Highlands, you have to do that as well, because that may not fit for them, especially those that have been in those configurations for years and years and years. They don't have constituent LMEs except for that one. So again, if we're looking for additional options to meet the needs of PBH, that's fine, as long as we don't dictate that Model 3 is going to work for everyone, because frankly, I don't think it will.
Mr. Jordan.
Even within an existing LME that's not going through a merger, let's take ECBH, for example. If they just did this community oversight board just from the standpoint of three members from each county, they would have a community oversight board split up by region or wherever, how they chose to regionalize themselves. They would have a constituent board of 57 individuals that would have local representation, and I think it would be incumbent upon them to decide, you know, how they regionalize county by county, area by area within that. And I think that Model 3 would work within those who are currently configured without the need of merger and those who have just merged within the past year or so.
Could I have a follow-up to that? Then how would that apply to Center Point?
Center Point would have the option of setting up within their counties three reps from each one of the counties as this would be constructed, and they could choose to regionalize as they wanted to, or they could have one large community oversight board.
They got one they've been ignoring.
Ms. Troutman.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hang on one second.
I'm sorry. So to clarify, Steve, what we're saying is Centerport could kind of stay the way they are or adopt Model 3. Is that what you're seeing in terms of options? Because, again, what I don't want to do is displace successes we already have.
I think they would have the option. By the way, I'm not speaking for the world here. But they would have the option of setting themselves up within this with one community oversight board if they chose to, or having one by the county. I think it adds local governance at that level to how localized you want to be at that point. I think the one issue that it would create would be probably in Mecklenburg, where it's one county. And I think they would need flexibility to work in and around that structure.
Let me interject one thing on the single county. We're going to get to single counties, actually, at some point in time, but we're going to sort of get there today, but I don't think that's going to happen. But the only thing I would just maybe throw into this particular interchange is that, and you tell me if I'm getting this wrong, but we do need to make sure that we have, whichever model that that or menu of models, if it comes out to be that, that we're getting on there at the level of the type of expertise we need, because it is, as somebody, I think a couple of people mentioned, it is a very different animal than an LME, and the MCO is a very different animal, and what may seem to, and I'm not saying anything about any particular conversion, but I'm just saying in general, long-term success, I think, requires that be there. So anyway, I'll leave it at that. But Ms. Coker, I'm sorry.
I just want to say something about risk management. Everybody in this room, everybody that is a citizen of our state, is a stakeholder. But the consumer is the one that bears the biggest risk in the decisions we're making right now. And this third model, it's possible, especially if an LME director really doesn't understand how important the voice of the system user is to shaping the future, it's possible that you could have an LME board with one CFEC member who may be a family member or maybe a consumer. And I'm telling you, you're shooting yourselves in the foot despite your whatever, however that goes. We have to be much more proactive. I mean, this opportunity to look at governance is in part because, yes, we're changing models, but it's also because this government, what we've had has not been working well. However, what I know that constituents across the state, as far as community members, they want to be ensure that there is local voice, and the only way they can really leverage that is with safety is through an elected official. And I just would like for folks to reconsider that maybe if model one were just, if we just simply kept the county commissioners appointed all members, but then broke down the compilation of who was supposed to be on the board. I mean, if ultimately with model two, we'd go to the county to approve what got put before them anyway. This model three, I love the way it really invites community participation with those community oversight boards. But governance is really, you can't just have one or two members from an oversight board inform the governance piece. I mean, the reality is that there's got to be a much more proactive way of informing the board.
Can I bridge off that for a second and just say, if you had something along, if you had something along this model three, that, and this may be something you need to think about, we're running short on time, but if you had model three and you added in there sufficient protections to make sure that you had a full consumer voice work into that model at the top governance level, it would be, at least from your perspective, it would be potentially amenable model. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, because when I look down here, I think, well, golly, the person who bears the biggest risk in this whole picture may not even be here. It may be a family member, and some family members are wonderful and supportive, but some family members put glass ceilings over their loved ones' heads. I mean, you know, the perspective of the person who lives with it is so important to this whole picture, and this doesn't guarantee the inclusion of even one of those voices. But, yeah, I mean, I could see working with an oversight board and a governance structure if there was some way to ensure that there were actual consumers and some family members on there.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, just...
Commissioner Crew.
If I could add in that, echo what I think Rebecca said earlier, is that, and I think from the complexity, because look at East Carolina, look at PBH, two very large LMEs, they're going to benefit more by having a structure like Model 3. Whereas the smaller you get geographically and you land up with just one thing, they may want to choose to go that. I think that's where you got to present both models, let the local LMEs determine how best they want to organize that, but have that guarantee that you do. Because, you know, look at this. We look at, I think we're saying maybe it's mutually exclusive, but if you look at six members of special expertise, you know, odds are you can find somebody that's got financial expertise that is a family member of a consumer. That, you know, that you don't automatically, they're not going to just be somebody that's just a no personality CPA. Of course, I know CPAs don't have a lot of personality, but the you know, you could get people that you could get somebody.
I think that, you need to clarify that you are a CPA.
No, I'm not a CPA. I'm actually in risk management. So,
All right.
but I'm all, you know, like my situation, I'm in have about 12 years experience in the insurance industry. I'm a commissioner. But also have a child that was marginally developmentally disabled. That helped me to identify in all three areas. So I think that's what you got to realize is you can guarantee that you have family members or consumers, but those people may also have these other expertise. But it's not going to be mutually exclusive.
Senator Tucker.
Just a follow-up question to Ms. Coker. Ms. Coker, don't these individuals, the consumers, still have the opportunity to contact their county commissioner and voice a problem that they have? And isn't it incumbent upon the commissioner to could pursue the same avenue he would whether or not they appointed the individual or not?
They do, and we do. But it took, because of the lack of clarity in the statute, it took our county commissioner. We finally maneuvered our county commissioners into having Mark come do a presentation about their role. Was that about 3 years ago, Mark? Do you remember? Something like that. And until then, they were pretty hands-off and said everything was up to the state. And they were real frustrated, too, with some things, issues with the LME, because they didn't understand that they had, that there was more power that they had than they realized. So that some things, the community's been able to leverage some changes in the last 3 years through our county commissioners being involved. And that's probably part of why I'm speaking so much about the necessity of the county's role.
Okay, we're up against Mr. Farmer.
Mr. Chair, just one quick comment. Having just seen this, I can see at ECBH for 19 counties some benefits in Model 3, but at the same time, I'd kind of like to see a statute like the one we currently have in that you have options. So if my county commissioners on my board says, well, we don't like that. We want to be involved, so we could go with the current statute and do as we've been doing, or if we can present Model 3 and they like that, we could have that option. I'd just like to present that.
Okay. Well, we are at the 5 o'clock hour, and I want to respect everybody's time, and some folks have a ways to drive. Let's do this. What we will do is y'all do some more thinking and cogitating, I guess, and discussions on these 3 miles. We'll come back. We'll start here. We'll pick back up at our March the 12th meeting. That's our next meeting, March the 12th, back in this room, 2 to 5. And let me just say this. I really do appreciate your attendance here and your willingness to grind this out. I know it's very difficult, and it's hard to get through a lot of this stuff, but you know, we've had so many fits and starts over the years, and mental health is such a very difficult area that it's probably more important for us to take whatever time we need, well, within bounds, and try to make sure that we are going in the right direction. And I just greatly appreciate your patience and your perseverance in this process, and I'm sure I'll be thanking you for that more as our meetings move forward. Again, please make sure that you get your reimbursement forms to Ms. Hobby, but also a number of people did send comments and things and further thoughts as they sort of crystallize in your mind. Please feel free to continue to route those to Pat. That's very, very helpful and help us to keep trying to frame and focus in on our discussion so that we can have very productive time. Again, appreciate everybody being here today and all of your input, and with that, the meeting is adjourned.